Okay. So this is our Q&A call number 7, and it's our second call with a special focus on early developmental trauma. And Jen, you want to say hi and
Sure. It's great to be here. I always enjoy doing these calls with Seth. I do want to just give you a little heads up that I work hard to have good tech, and I'm staying in a town where my Wi-Fi might drop a couple out. Just know if that will be right.
oh, your Wi-Fi is your internet's a little choppy right now, Jen. You're freezing there a bit.
All right, let me try a different option.
So we will get going pretty soon, and hopefully that internet connection will work itself out. Jen is traveled right now for our training, and so yeah, it may be a little spotty, but hopefully it will work. Looks like it's a
Can
little
you hear
slower
me about
now.
that?
Yeah, I can. Yep.
Yeah, it's good 98% of the time. So hopefully we'll be in good shape and you're there if I'm not there. So
Okay. And if worse comes to worse, you can always turn your video off, and just do audio, and that usually fixes it too.
yeah. It actually drops though. It's almost like someone in the Comcast place, it's like they turn it off and turn it on is how it feels like once an hour.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. So before we get into the questions, we just wanted to start with just a little overview. Just why are we doing this? Why have this special focus on early developmental trauma? And what are some common experiences for people who have that, which is so many of us? Well, it's something that has really only come more into our awareness, I think, in the last few years, just how prevalent this is. And it takes a bit of a refinement of understanding, well, what is trauma, right? Because, of course, most people think it's the big things, right? Which they are, right? Assault or war or natural disaster, big abuse in the home, right? Severe neglect, all that, of course, is traumatic. But it's these more subtle stressors, misattunements or unattunement, parents that just don't know how to connect because they never got it themselves. And they're chronically stressed because they're working all the time. And things like surgical experiences early on that are maybe necessary to save the life of the infant, but is hugely traumatic. And that's rarely recognized as the case. So there can be so many things that have been normalized. Of course, the cry it out method, spanking, children should be seen and not heard, emotional repression, having to repress your authenticity in order to maintain the attachment. We talked about that last time. So there's so many ways in which these more sort of insidious, subtle things can build up over time. And it has an effect very often of making it such that the primary wirings that we are supposed to form that enable us to tell, like, oh, this is safe, this is not safe, this is me, this is not me, right? Just basic foundational things. I feel okay in the world. My home space just feels like a safe haven that I can rest into, but or not, right? So when that happens, there's a lot of wiring that may need to get linked up for the first time. And the effect of that, in terms of doing this work, is that we may need to go much slower. We may need to focus really on building capacity rather than following sensations and really getting into the emotions and lots of expression. It may be that that has to come a little bit later. Or it has to be very pendulated with lots of resourcing, lots of connecting to external things. So it's an important distinction. And understanding where one is along that spectrum of, what am I in my real capacity? Do I still need to figure out what my real capacity is even? Did I learn so early to work from a place of survival? that I never actually figured out what my real sort of tolerance for activation is or experience. There can be a wide range of spectrum in terms of that kind of capacity. And sometimes it's just a process in itself of figuring out where we are in that. And then we can start to shape how we work, how we do this work appropriately. Anything else you want to say there, Jen? Just like a general sense, sort of overview?
Yeah. You can hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. So the only thing I'll add, Seth, is that, you know, the intention is that we learn, if we do have a history that includes early developmental trauma, you know, Seth talked about we want to build capacity and focus more there on the feeling and the expressing, right? Like 100%, but it's someone like, I remember one time I was at Esalen in California and we were talking about Buddhism and the guy said, well, it's not that you are the Buddha, it's that a direction that you're aiming towards. It's sort of like guidance that you're aiming towards, because a lot of times when we come into this and we, you know, we might feel nothing or we might feel so much that it's hard to feel just a little, right? So sometimes it's just about, at first it might just be about if we feel a lot, like we feel a lot, like while like we're doing some containment and we know that we're in our home and we're not under imminent threat, right? So I just want to kind of point out that these are things that we're actually like building towards, but it might take some time for us to grow that ability. And sometimes, especially if we've been in freeze for a long time, it might help just to have a huge cry or to get really mad or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And so there's space for both like big emotions and then also just what gets underemphasized is the emphasis on building capacity and learning to feel a little at a time or express a little at a time. So those are really important, but also something that we're sort of a practice that we're moving towards, not something that we're going to come in expecting ourselves to be able to do if we've never done it before.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so important to have a lot of patience and for ourselves, compassion for ourselves when we are figuring this stuff out. I mean, it's interesting because this work is based on science and biology, and yet the application of it is more like an art form where you have to like mess up and make a little mess and then clean it up. And right, it's much more sort of organic in that way. It's not an exact science. And it's a really good point Jen made there about, yeah, it's not always, sometimes, yeah, we just feel too much all the time. And we have to learn actually how to feel less or how to come out of that inner experience. Sometimes it's that we don't feel anything at all. And we have to learn to start to find little nuance of sensation that leads some eventually to emotion. Yeah, sometimes we need to have a cork pop out of the bottle, so to speak. And we have this big cry or anger that's more than we actually are ready for, but it just kind of has to happen. And then we sort of pack it up and realize, okay, that happened and that's good. And now I'm feeling that. And now I need to resource. Now I need to contain and soothe and distract myself because that was a lot. Yeah, very good. So just some common experiences. We put together a little list. Just that I'm going to read through of just very common experiences for people who have early developmental trauma. So chronic experiences, chronic tension, chronic fatigue. Those are sort of two flip sides of the activation coin. Chronic tension is someone more who's stuck in activation, sympathetic activation, and everything is kind of braced. Everything is firing. Yep. I see someone raising their hands. Yep. Yep. And chronic fatigue is more the other side of the thing where we've been in freeze and the system is more collapsed, hard to get any energy, very lethargic. Both of those are common indicators of this early developmental trauma being in the picture. Another thing we see is what's called global high intensity activation, which is just sort of like vibrating like a live wire. That's sort of what we're saying, how you're just feeling so much all the time. Also a tendency to push, like the personality is just go, 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 push, 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 push through everything all the time. Sometimes there is a lack of sense of self. Like there can be just sort of an I don't really know who I am. I don't know why I'm here. What's the point? What's the purpose? Why bother? Where do I stop and other people begin? Messy sense of sort of boundaries, or maybe a sense of like, just I don't belong here, or there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with the world. I mean, of course, we can all agree there's various things wrong with the world, but there can be, you know, this sense of like, I just don't fit, or just nothing's right. It's off. Something feels off all the time. Everything feels dangerous. Attachment issues. That's a big one. There's problems in relationships, feeling codependent or pushing people away, doing both, being really anxious about our partner and if they're going to still be with us, and then maybe we go into compensatory behaviors where like we're mean and angry because we're anticipating them leaving. All these types of things can show up in various ways with attachment. And then syndromes. So all the different syndromes, fibromyalgia, autoimmune disorders, multiple chemical sensitivity, Crohn's, all of these things that tend to come after the system's been in dysregulation for a long period of time. So those sometimes come later down the line, but not always. So just common stuff that we see. And it's not unusual. If you find yourself with one or many of these things, it's just there's probably some early developmental trauma in the picture, as there is for so many of us. And so, okay.
Can I just have one quick thing?
Absolutely.
And you might have said this, I missed just a teeny bit, but that global high intensity activation, it can show up as one of two extremes. Like one is the live wire all the time, but then the other is like kind of shut down, like fawning, good, you know, like, so just that, so that can have two faces.
Like more in the fear side of
things. You have more of the don't feel as much, you know, everything's okay on the surface. Then as you do the work, you might discover the other version, which is where you feel like a live wire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And just so you know, Jen, it looks like your video is frozen again, but your audio is coming through. So it's possible you'll have to switch to audio at some point. Okay. So this first question, we were just talking about attachment stuff. This is right in line with that. I've noticed I tend to push people away. I've never had a great loving relationship either. I'm wondering if I have some abandonment issues. When I was born, my mom went back to work when I was only 6 weeks old. Another family looked after me and they were good people, but could this have caused some issues for me around love and security? So yeah. And again, here we are. This is one of those things that is not like, no, very few people understand that this is traumatic for a developing human being. It's so normal. Like, yeah, of course, mom's there for 6 weeks and then she goes back to work. And you got the family down the street who's taking care, or maybe it's a daycare, or it's a grandparent. So yeah, absolutely. Even though they were good people, which is fantastic, that at least they were good people that you were left with, nothing replaces that primary bond. Now, a father can also serve as that, but really early on, it's kind of hard to replace mama. I mean, you were in mama for 9 months. You're hearing her voice all the time from the inside as she's speaking. You're sharing her feelings. You're literally one being, and then you're two. And so that is, we can't really underestimate the power of that, how potent that is, that connection. So it's no substitute, even if it's a good family, to suddenly lose mama. I mean, that is a huge attachment rupture that has been normalized in our society. And absolutely, it can lead to this, what you describe as wanting to push people away. And it'd be interesting, I think, to explore working with the energy of that push. Is there a way that, when you're not in that behavior, like you're not in the context of the relationship itself, that you can tap into the sense of that pushing away, because that's essentially, it's a self-protective response. Like, I'm going to push you away so that you don't leave me. It's a way of making it safer and under your control. So there is likely some aggression in there that is wanting to come through. Now, also, it's very likely that underneath that, there is a bunch of loss, maybe some much more tender kind of feelings, hurt, abandonment, right? Like you say. So one thing that came to my mind as just a purely somatic exploration of this is getting something that you can push literally against. And maybe you sort of tap into the sense of what happens to you when you feel yourself wanting to push people away. Or maybe you do this when that's actually occurring. Or maybe you just do this just purely as a somatic exercise without any context. There's many different ways you can try it. So just setting something out that you can push on. So this could be a pillow against a wall or something like that. It could be very powerful, to do with another person. If you have a safe person that you can push against and you sort of set it up ahead of time, like you agree, look, you resist me, but you have to let me win. That's the sort of the agreement beforehand. And you feel what it's like to literally push someone away with your strength, getting some resistance, but you are going to win. And you even push them across the room a bit. They take some steps back as you push them. What's that like to feel that and to see that experience of pushing away? Then what might it be like as part of that or as a separate thing? Like once you push, your arms are kind of out. And I wonder what it would be like to sort of change the orientation of the arms, and then you're reaching instead of pushing. What might it feel like to feel that sense of reaching out for someone versus pushing away? Even if there's no one there, you can do it just with intention, like, oh, I'm going to push, or I'm going to reach because I want, right? That might be kind of a valuable exploration in terms of navigating what's happening here, which is essentially a deep loss. And I think the most fundamental thing there is probably I want, I need. But on top of that is this defense, which is go away, because you're going to hurt me. So exploring those with your body, either by yourself or with a safe person, might be an interesting way to work with that. All right. Jen, are you still there? Looks like she might be having some internet stuff.
Yeah, I'm here. Oh. But can you unmute me on my other login?
Oh boy, it sounds like you've got a psychedelic delay on your voice. Let's see what happens if you... Are you just on audio?
Other login.
Ah, it looks like you're logged in twice or something. Let me see if I can remove one of you. Just a moment. Sorry about this, folks. No, I only see you once, Jen. So maybe while you're figuring that out, I will go ahead and move on to the next one. So I have early developmental trauma, no touch as a baby, no talking and no expression of emotion. I have a void inside, which feels like part grief, and another part is a sense of no self, like there's nothing, nothing there, no wants, no needs or feelings. It feels like a black empty hole. I am really noticing it. I have difficulty attaching, and I've always known something was missing inside. I just thought that I was broken, like a defect. Is noticing it more, I'm 62 years old. Is that considered progress, even though it is disturbing? Absolutely. So first off, I just want to say this makes complete sense. If you were not touched as a baby, if there was no expression of emotion, no sharing, no talking, left alone, yeah, that's a huge, huge wound. And I can totally understand how that would feel like this void, this absence inside, because you weren't met appropriately. So yeah, it totally makes sense. And yes, you are correct that feeling it more in this case is likely a sign that you're actually making progress. It kind of sucks, but very often in order for these things to change, we first have to feel them fully. And again, we don't want to dive into that, but it sounds like this is happening naturally. It sounds like you're starting to just feel this sense of this void more and more. And that is a sign that your capacity is growing, because it's likely that your body and mind would have protected you from feeling that. Right? It sounds like before maybe you sensed just a blankness, but now you're actually sensing some of the hurt, perhaps, that's in that black hole, as well as still a sense of sort of a no self as well. So yes, this definitely makes sense. And I would say that it's considered progress. I think that an important thing to work, or important way you could work with this, is to really understand the principles of pendulation and how important that is in a case like this. So pendulation, again, is simply the idea of moving our attention from one place to another. And there's many ways we can do this. So one way is within the body. So you say you have a sense of void inside. Well, first, where is that? See if you can discover, where is that sense of void? Is it in a part of your body? Maybe it's in the belly or the heart. See if you can discover that. And then, where is an area of your body that is not at all like that, that feels different? Now, it may not be like sunshine and rainbows, but it may just be a sense of neutrality or solidness, or I can feel texture here. I can feel a sense of meatiness or me. I don't know what it will be exactly, but finding some place in you that feels different. Another way to do this is with image, is because you said it's like a black hole. Well, okay, if you can feel where that is and see the image of that black hole, well, what image is different than the black hole? What might that be? And maybe that is something outside of you even. So for example, that's another way of pendulating, is going from the inside to the outside. And sometimes that can be a little bit easier with something so intense as this. That might be a way to start, actually, is just, okay, I have this sense of a black hole, an image of a black hole. Maybe I can start to locate where that is. And then I open my eyes. Where is something that's not at all like that? And this may mean maybe you bring in something purposeful. Maybe you have a piece of artwork or some flowers or something that's very alive. And you see that and you see, well, can I see that and get a sense of the color of that, the aliveness of that? That's different. And that's out there. And then, okay, this is here. In here, okay, there's that, but then, oh, that's out there, and that's alive. And notice just what happens. It may be that as you do that, some other feeling occurs within you. Something else may spark up. And another thing to consider is, What are some things that are safe to attach to? So this is kind of like what I was just talking about. Maybe it's that painting or those flowers or a tree. Maybe it's a pet. Maybe it's a plant. Yeah. Finding something that does feel like, you know what? Yeah, I can connect with this. And then what does it feel like to connect with that thing that's safe? And again, this may happen in little pieces. It's something that may take a lot of practice, because that is such a foundational wound of not having that touch and that connection early on. But you certainly can build it by building the connection with yourself and with the environment. All right, Jen, it looks like you're back. I skipped the one that you were going to do. Do you want to do that one now? Oh, just a second. Got to make you co-host again. There you go. Can you do it now?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yay. Yeah, I switched devices, so it should be better. And I just want to share with you all that I give a lot of thought to my Wi-Fi. And I've been here 3 weeks. And other than the 1 minute issue, it's worked consistently until last night. And I did go get a hotspot, but that doesn't seem to be working. So hopefully this will work. I have three plans, A, B, and C. We're on C.
Thank you, Jen.
So yeah. So just maybe, yeah, I think we'll be good. So next question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sound like a plan?
Yeah.
So this question is, I was humiliated when I was afraid as a child and I stopped showing fears. Now I don't trust my feelings and have huge difficulties knowing what to feel fears for or not. It's mostly about my body. I need someone else to tell me that it's okay or not. And kind of the practices I'm doing, the way I'm approaching this works some days, then it's the same again. I feel I need to find this trust in myself, but how? I'm doing exercises, orienting, and a lot of soothing. It works for a short time, and then the fears are back. It's some shame in this as well. So there's some similarities, differences, but also similarities to what Seth just talked about. Mm-hmm. Right. So as you mentioned, when we're humiliated as a child, and then we're kind of taught to be afraid, then we just sort of have this default setting of fear and being afraid. And that also kind of creates a sense of chronic sense of threat and toxic shame, right? So it can just be good to know that, because you say like you don't trust your feelings, whether to feel the fears or not, to know that there's sort of this default setting of fear, right? Because when that's the case, we can start to consciously check, right? A lot of this work is about, we get the physiological signals of safety. So we can consciously check, okay, here I am. I am sitting in a living room. I feel my hand on my arm. I see the light coming in the window. Is there anything telling me, what are the signals of safety? And is there anything telling me that I'm not safe, right? Because we can just let ourselves know through our physiological cues that we're giving, noticing the surface we're on. We can move, let's say, we can move in many ways, but fingers or toes are often helpful. But so we give ourselves these cues over and over again that in the moment, there are signs of safety. And then we can consciously check to notice, yes, right now, there is an absence of threat, even though my system knows very well how to generate these signals of threat, right? And so cognitively knowing that there's a very well-practiced pattern of threat signaling can be helpful, right? Because otherwise we're just gonna be feeling these feelings of threat. And what happens is that our mind looks to pattern match. And so it'll go and try and find something that matches this thing, this signal that we're getting that there's a threat present. And so we just wanna know that cognitively so we can practice over and over and over again, right? You say it works some days and then it's the same again, right? Part of that is that it takes time, right? Some of us have done this for 20, 30, you know, up to 70 or 80 years. So it can take time to create a new pattern in the nervous system. So knowing that, right? And so what we do, as you've heard us say, is we can look for little signs of difference, right? Is it easier for me to notice more quickly what's happening and that I can come back to the present more quickly. Excuse me. Do I yawn or do I take a deeper breath or do I, does my system have more access to settling? Do I have more awareness? So these could be, it could be many things and they could be subtle. Sometimes too, if we're practicing and we don't notice much changing, it can also be a sign to titrate a bit more or to do what we were talking about earlier, which is focus on growing capacity, right? So, yeah, the three things there, it can take some time. It might be a clue to titrate more or to focus more on capacity. You talk about not knowing whether to trust your fears or not, right? So you might have, some of this was kind of, you might infer from what I just shared, but know that a lot of the time, the fear is going to be just habitual, right? Because we learned there was an early absence of safety, so we learned to default to fear. So that's where we want to check it out though, right? We give ourselves a cue so we can learn over time to have more access to feelings of safety and we check it out so that we know there's also, that helps to build that self-trust that you're talking about, because we know that I can tell that, you know, the sun is shining. There's no one else here except all of you lovely people on Zoom, which I'm grateful to be able to talk to you at the moment, right? So that helps to build that self-trust. Yeah, I'm just trying to see which other piece of this I might have missed. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention is that sometimes some of these experiences can be all be mixed together, right? We can feel shame. We can feel a lack of self-trust. We can feel fear. There might be some sadness or grief. And so over time, as we grow capacity, knowing that it can be helpful, we start to tease them out and then we can work more individually. And of course, I didn't mention healthy aggression, but that one tends to bubble up and it can be a really important one in growing the access to self and sense of agency. But Seth, what would you add there?
Not much. I mean, yeah, that's it. I think it's important to recognize that what you said about the brain will try to pattern match, right? That's very important to recognize. And also that it's oftentimes a lot easier to stay in that than to break it. Like, which sounds weird because it's really stressful to always, you know, be anticipating or looking for threat or thinking, oh, it must be this thing that's scary or must be this thing that's a problem. But in some ways it can be easier to stay at that level because at least it's familiar, right? Like I know how to be worried all the time about everything, but this idea of like what, like actually name that things are safe, like that may, it, there may be resistance to doing that is all I want to say, because it's like, that's weird, right? That's unusual. What am I doing talking to myself saying, here I am in my home in Vancouver, British Columbia, the time is right. Like, but it really can help to consciously name the things yeah. that are present that tell us we're safe.
Yes.
Yeah.
That it's a huge point to know that, you know, we're very well practiced at what we're well practiced at doing. So if our mind is very well practiced at finding things that look scary or like threatening, then to know that as we, it's going to be, we're going to say like, what, safe? No, what, like, you know, like, No, there's a lot to be scared about right now. Right. And so just anticipating that can be helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I did two in a row when you were off there, Jen. Do you want to do your next one in green?
Sure.
There?
Okay. I will jump. Yep, I got it. Okay. Yep. So this next question is, it's my sixth round of SBSM. I have EDT, early developmental trauma. My question is, why do I feel so bad and my chronic fatigue syndrome symptoms worsen when I get triggered and slip into freeze? Also, what are your thoughts on setting boundaries in order to reduce triggers, most especially at work? Can you hear me okay?
So yeah, you had a little bit of choppiness, but.
Okay. I can barely get through my 3 short days of work most weeks and have to rest the other 4 days. So remember that we go into freeze when we are experiencing more than we have the capacity to handle, right? With chronic fatigue, there's a connection between freeze and fatigue often, right? So when we're in freeze, we don't have as much access to our life force. We don't have as much access to our energy, right? It's that state that we go into shutdown. So it makes a lot of sense that when there's more stimuli or more stress, you go into freeze and then your symptoms would worsen, right? So I'm going to turn off my video to see if that helps while I talk. So reducing stress when you can, right? We can't always do that. But when we can, reducing stress can be important, right? So 100% yes, if that's an option, that then do that wherever you can, right? If you also, sometimes there can be repair and finding support. So if you have an ally, or if you even share, you know, in the peer-to-peer site of SBSM, that might be helpful. The other thing to remember is that when we have CFS, we have a small window of tolerance, right? That they very often go hand in hand. And also with early developmental trauma, we have a small window of tolerance. So knowing that anything you can do to just learn what that is for you and to start to explore respecting that can be important. And something to think about is the rest is important. You mentioned that I have 3 short days of work and then I rest for 4 days, right? So this may not be possible because I hear that you need to work, but where you can sort of alternate periods of exertion or stress with periods of rest, it can be really helpful. Like almost thinking it of a sandwich, right? I rest, I do something stressful or exert myself, and then I rest again. And that's a way that we help to build capacity, and especially for those of us who have CFS. Yeah, there's almost like, you can almost think of it like a rhythm of rest is how I think of it. Exertion and rest. Anything to add there, Seth?
There can be periods that just, I want to agree that there can be periods of this work where it's really important to minimize our stressors as much as possible. Now, someone out there might be saying, what the hell are you talking about, Seth? Because last call, you were talking about how we're not trying to avoid triggers with this work necessarily, right? Because they were saying this, Irene's voice triggers me. And so we need more lessons recorded by Seth, right? So, okay. So, I'm saying 2 things here, but yeah, both are true. So we don't want to try to go out of our way to avoid triggers and try to make everything right all the time, we may want to minimize our stressors as much as possible, depending on where we're at. And you know, if you're talking about the workplace and things that occur in the workplace, that if it's possible, it seems like a good idea to set some boundaries. Also, because setting boundaries is an expression of your agency, an expression of your authenticity, and that can be supportive in building up that underlying capacity. Like, you know what? I can speak up for myself. I can advocate for myself. The only other thing that occurred to me was, on the days that you're resting, are you really resting? Right? Because there can be many ways in which we say we're resting, but in fact, we're stimulating ourselves, especially in this day and age of devices. You know, if you're chilling out on the sofa, immobile, but you're scrolling and getting all sorts of dopamine hits and blue light exposure into your eyes, which is stimulating the cortisol, well, you're not really resting. So just be mindful of when you're resting, are you really resting? So that'll be helpful. And what you said, Jen, about alternating that rest, like I think even, yeah, during your days off, how can you sandwich little bits of positive stress in with the rest? Like, and that can be very little, right? That may mean you just go for a walk around the block, but it's a little bit of mobilization, a little bit of more sympathetic-y kind of stuff. And then again, true rest as again, in service of building that capacity over time. Yeah.
Can I add one more thing? So the only other thing I want to add, because I know there are a number of people in our community who have chronic fatigue. I just want to acknowledge that chronic fatigue ranges from severe to mild. And so for someone, getting out of bed might be actually a huge stressor, right? So the fact that this person, whoever asked the question, is able to work 3 days a week points more in the direction of mild. So it's important to acknowledge, to provide the context that we're answering based on how this person asked. If you have CFS and you're not able to get out of bed, then you would want to, you know, you might be able to apply some of the concepts, but it would look very different in practice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Jen. Yeah. Okay. I've had multiple types of abuse and betrayal over different periods of my life. When I practice what Seth has mentioned in the Q&As, such as statements like, I survived, I'm here, I'm alive, these are my arms, right, et cetera, like I talked about, just sort of naming the parts. When I do that, my mind quickly corrects it to we, as in we survive, we are here. I feel like each period of abuse happened to a different part of me, almost like a different person. Any tips for better integration of these parts? We feels correct, but also unsettling. So totally normal, okay? Just that is a very normal adaptation for a person to make when we're going through especially multiple different kinds of abuse from multiple people. Yeah, there can be this fragmentation of the self, essentially, where it's like, yeah, it's like, okay, that's the part of me that's stuck at 4 years old. And that's the part of me that's the pissed, angry teenager. And that's the part of me that wanted to run away when I was 10. And that's the part, right? That they can have, there can be distinct senses of self within us. I certainly have experienced that for sure. So yeah, not unusual at all. And I think it's fine to use the we. What I would suggest as a starting place is how can that we exist within a unified container, which is you. So how can you set yourself up as like the parent or like the caretaker, the guardian of your various parts of self? You are and by you, I mean the one who wrote this question, asking about this, your higher brain, your consciousness. That is sort of an overarching you, and all of the various parts, they all exist within the container of that you, within the container of your body. So that can be another interesting exploration, is like, okay, we're all in here together, guys, you know, like, and where are we? Right. And so where is this one sense of this one part of me? Where do you live? And maybe you live over here down in my, near my liver. And this other part feels like they're in my heart. And this other part is kind of like in my back. And this other part really wants to use my arms. The other part wants to run away. Just starting to explore what are the different aspects of my physiology associated with these parts. And then what do those parts want to do? Right? How can I start to mobilize these parts of self? And that is a big part of integration, because when you do that, you are using your body, which is the container of all, right? Your container holds all of these parts. Essentially, it's about building relationship. You're building relationship with these parts of yourself by exploring, where are they? What do they look like? How old are they? What's the image? And how do they feel? What's the emotional state? Art can sometimes be helpful in this regard. Drawing. You don't have to be like a quote unquote artist. Like maybe it's just like this part of me is like this and it's this color, and I'm going to kind of do this shape. And then this part of me is like this over here, and it's this color and it's this shape. Maybe this part feels like a little creature over here. And it's like, you know, you can express it and put it down in various ways, which again is all in service of building relationship, building consciousness and connection. And then coming back to the container of self, we're all in here. We're all in this one unified bowl. Yeah, that's all I got on that one. Jen?
So I'll just add one thing before I go on to the next question, which is that just to acknowledge that we might not yet have the imprint. I do believe that everyone has wholeness. It's just sort of, you know, in ourselves, but we might not have the imprint of that sort of, that we have, might not have experienced that sort of in this human incarnation, so to speak. And so just to know that if that feels unfamiliar or foreign or not easy to access at first, that that's really understandable. And if that's the case, you might look like on TV shows or in books or in nature to see if you can find sort of like models of that wholeness or symbols of that wholeness. So that's the only thing I would add there. Mm-hmm. So next question. Sound okay at the moment?
You're a little glitchy. You may want to go to audio only.
Okay, I'll do audio only. Any better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm a 45-year-old woman who had severe childhood sexual abuse from ages 1 to 21. I know I block a lot of the abuse, and I know I need to heal. Here's my question. When I was lifting weights, doing the bench press, I had a muscle memory and flash of trying to push my abuser off of me. I cried and used containment to cope. How is this beneficial for muscle memory flashback to come to the surface? Am I just re-traumatizing myself, or is this the healing way? Because man, it's brutal. So yeah, I hear you. So you asked first, am I re-traumatizing myself? Right? Well, you asked why, but I'm going to go to the, so I'm going to start by saying that really important point is that we have innate self-protective responses. You know, it's a big component of this work. And as we grow capacity and awareness and regulation, we have more access to them and they come to the surface. We want that to happen. That allows us to renegotiate an event that caused a trauma. And it allows us to complete what we call in somatic experiencing, we call it an incomplete self-protective response. So I know I hear that it's brutal. And the fact that this came up is actually a positive sign, right? At first, just staying present while this comes up, right? That might be what we have access to. So we go where we have access to. So the fact that you cried and used containment to get through, that's great, right? You know that you're here now. If you can just sort of know, like you're in the gym, if there's a familiar person that you know and who's relatively safe, right? Orienting to those things can be helpful. As we have the capacity to do this, we can consciously work with that impulse, right? This is the follow your impulse lesson from early in SBSM. And so you had the impulse to push your abuser off of you, right? So what we can do when it feels accessible is to really tune into that impulse and slow down and feel what wants to happen. And then as we're feeling what wants to happen, we can also imagine that what didn't get to happen gets to happen. So for example, it might be that you had, even if let's say you were a little kid and this was a big adult, in this scenario, that you had the strength, right, to actually push that person away. You might also, in this case, because you were so young when some of this happened, what didn't get to happen might have been someone coming in to protect you. and to say, hey, like, this is not okay. We need to like take this person and get them help, and we need to take care of you, right? So you're looking for, you're asking the question, what wants to happen and what didn't get to happen. And then you can use your impulse, your body, right, your movement, and your imagination to renegotiate the event. When it's something that happened over time, we may need to do it repeatedly, right? And we might have, for example, at first we might have lots of grief. And then as we work through that, we might have some fear, but then the healthy aggression start to become more and more accessible. So we want to just know that it might happen in layers, and that we tend to grow access to different parts of our experience over time as we stay with the work. There was one more thing I wanted to mention, which is that two things actually. One, when this happens so young, it's by definition early developmental trauma. So really bringing in the idea of a supportive other, whether it's in real life or in your imagination, is really important, right? Someone there who's with you, who's helping to protect you, right? Who's helping to keep you safe. And then the other piece, remember, with early trauma, at least when this is going back to the start of the call, we want to titrate, right? So we want to find those small, at first things might be big. This is what we said at the beginning. Like, we might just, the feelings come up and we're just with them in the best that we can. And that's fabulous. But then as we have more access, we want to kind of take a little piece at a time so that we can really stay with our experience and also work closer within our true capacity. And that helps things to integrate. And this does really change over time. And yeah. So Seth, anything to add there?
No, I think it's great that the person used containment. They thought to do that. Like, they allowed the emotion to come. Also, just the fact that this happened organically, like you said, you know, that shows that it's ready to start happening. And that is the way of healing, is to have these, what you call flashback, come up. And it sounds like you responded completely appropriately. Right? You allowed the emotion, you thought to contain yourself, you to cope with the experience. Fantastic. And then maybe later, you can start to think about, maybe what would have been like to push. And like Jen said, bring in the image of that. Or maybe we bring in an imaginary helper. I mean, there's all sorts of ways. But we got to remember that our imagination is powerful and limitless. So that's a lot of what the annihilation work is about, which you may or may not be ready to do. But it could be interesting if you haven't read that article yet to at least read it. Because this is the essence of that, like self-protection, imagining ourselves being able to do what didn't get to happen. All right. Just take a little pause here. We've been going 50 minutes, and I usually do a pause sooner. So let's just pause for a moment. And if you need to go get a drink or go to the bathroom or anything, let's just take a minute here and do a little orientation break, self-care break. It was such an interesting transition. Before this call, I was outside burning. It's springtime here, and everyone's burning their burn piles. And so I was just like totally immersed in like sun and fire and smoke and just these primal elements. And then like I came in, I got on the computer. I was like, "Well, where the hell am I?" total scene change. Oh man! All right. Great. Okay. So continuing on, and just, you know, we will be done certainly within an hour and a half, probably a little bit before that, but it won't be longer than that. Okay. Hi, Seth. I frequently find myself in arguments with people at counters and service desks, etc. I can be quite impolite. Interestingly, the only time I wasn't triggered was in Canada, where I find people to be extremely kind. Aw. And then I can be lovely myself. My question is, why do you think I have such an aggressive survival stress attitude? Could it be because I grew up with a single mother who always fought for us and perhaps instilled in me a belief that confrontation is necessary for survival? Well, that sounds very likely to me. And I'm glad to hear you had a lovely experience in Canada. Yes, we can be quite polite here, sometimes to our own detriment. Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting that it sounds like what's happening is you're not just being mean. If I'm reading this question right, it's not like you're randomly being aggressive. It sounds like you're being aggressive and impolite when you feel like that's what's coming at you. Like when the person at the desk is themselves rude or short or maybe whatever it is, like something's triggering that in you. Like you say, it's not just that you're randomly aggressive, because when people were met you with kindness, then you were able to respond with kindness. Now, ideally, we want to be able to respond with kindness and patience, even when people are being idiots, because that tends to make things go a little easier, right? And that takes capacity and all the stuff that we're doing, right? We have to learn to recognize, oh, I'm getting triggered and I don't need to act on that. And in fact, I'm going to feel my feet and maybe I'll let this energy come into my spine and maybe I'll just stand up a little straighter and maybe I'll take a breath and pause for a moment, right? So starting to bring in your basic somatic cues and tools, like start to recognize, oh, I'm about to go off on this person. And then maybe you can like, maybe I'll just do something else instead. You know, but ultimately what's going on here is there's fight in your system. For whatever reason, you got a lot of fight in you. Now, that's not always a bad thing. That, like I said, like that can give you a lot of sense of agency and often like, this is me, my authenticity, right? My boundaries, my strength. Like that can be good. But yeah, it sounds like it's a bit uncontained, a bit out of control and sort of bursting out at the seams. So here's where this is exactly what the healthy aggression work, annihilation work, et cetera, is for. So again, I don't know where you are along the path. If you're ready to start doing that work, a nice intro into that work is the Vu Ah lesson, which is just released this last week. That, and also be sure to check out the ways, there's a supplemental video that I made of different ways to play with that. There's ways to titrate it and do the Vu Ah. So what might it be like to just imagine, remember the last person who was rude to you and sort of bring them into your mind. And then you just sort of, and you let that energy come out through your jaw, through your arms, through your hands, through your eyes, through whatever way it wants to come. Right? It's like, and starting to understand that you can get that stuff moving through your system when you're not getting triggered. That's the whole point of it. So that when the time comes and there's not so much stored up in there waiting to explode. And again, a lot of that in the moment, in the meantime, it's really going to be about how can you shift your focus, remember to stay in your body and notice what's going on. Right. It's like if you can start to realize I'm about to go off on this person. OK, because I can feel and you may still do it, like forgive yourself if that happens. Like, OK, you're working on it. But you need to start recognizing the somatic cues that tell you, oh, I'm about to yell at this person or I'm about to be impolite or rude or aggressive. Right. And then you can start to change it. It's like we have to know what we do before we can change it. Okay, next one. Hi, Seth. I have EDT and complex PTSD. Why, the more I do this work, the more depressed I become? I feel hopeless and apathetic. I loathe myself. My cognitive function declines. Some days I think I've aged 10 years overnight. Is this the energy I used to run away from by being functionally frozen? Is this the energy I used to run away from by being functionally frozen? I'm terrified to surrender to it in case I never come out of it. I fear I'm letting myself go. How can I know if it's that or that wants to be acknowledged and moved through, or if I'm falling deeper into freeze? Right. So this experience of feeling worse, hopeless, apathetic, you're asking, is that something that needs to be acknowledged and felt and moved through, or is it going deeper into freeze? And actually, it could go either way. So both can be true. So this is an example where it sounds like you may have doing more than you actually have the capacity for. Now, yes, we do need, like I said, we do need to feel the fullness of the freeze at some point. But it sounds like there's more than that happening here. There sounds like there's a lot of aggression that is showing up, but it's being directed inwards at yourself. And that is, of course, ultimately, why we go into freeze and why we have depression. What that is aggression that's been turned inwards, right? I couldn't get it out, so now it's pointed in, and the freeze is keeping it contained. So, and everything you're experiencing is kind of how freeze feels, but it sounds like this is a case where it may be important to take a break from the work entirely. We have a break week coming up next week, so that's good. I would encourage you to use that and don't do anything resembling this work. How can you just focus on taking care of yourself? Using your resources, soothing, whatever feels good and easy. How can you allow yourself to do that? And now that maybe nothing feels good. And, it's just like, oh, well, how can I find something that feels less bad? There's always an option. And even if it feels like, oh, everything sucks, well, there's always something that sucks a little less. Maybe, you can find that. And it's going to be about, I think, more orienting externally. I think that right now, from the sense I get from your question, it sounds like this isn't a time to try to just sit with it and be with it and let it move through. It sounds like it'd be more useful to actually distract yourself, come out of it, do what you need to sort of function, which you do know how to do. And if you lived in functional freeze for a long time, your system does know how to do that. Let's see if I have anything else here. Yeah, what it sounds like you say here, is this the energy I used to run away from by being functionally frozen? Yeah, in the sense that it sounds like freeze is not functional anymore. It sounds like what you're actually feeling is how freeze feels when it's not functional, which is when it's dominating the system. And again, remember, like that is, it's kind of supposed to prepare us for death. Like, oh my God, there's no point in anything because I'm about to die is the state of it. But, and so feeling hopeless, apathetic, et cetera, that is all normal, right? But the where you say, I loathe myself, that there's that aggression and that hatred that actually really needs to come out but the system, it sounds like, needs more capacity before that energy is ready to be directed outwards. So just a very important time, I think, to take a break from the work and just do what you need to do to take care of yourself, soothe yourself, whatever you can do to feel kind of okay, and do that for a while. I would say probably for more than a week. I'd probably say for at least 2-3 weeks. Just leave it and do something else. Jen, anything you want to add there?
Not to that one.
Or the one before?
Yeah, sound okay? I'll go off camera just in case, but can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you still have a little bit of that kind of glitchiness, yeah.
Better with camera off?
Yeah.
Great, okay. So the just a very quick thing, the question, the one before last about getting in arguments with people at counters and service desks, mm-hmm. Two very quick things. One is that Sometimes it's helpful to start to differ, to know that when we're having a really big reaction to something that seems kind of small today, to sort of differentiate between present and past. And not that we need to go back and where did none of that, but just it can be helpful to know, like, okay, this person just sort of looked at me the wrong way and I want to kill them. That tells me that this is likely touching into something from my past, right? And I don't know if that helps you, but for me, a lot of times it would help me to normalize and to have more compassion for my big reactions when they seem disproportionate to what was happening. And then know too, this is, we say this a lot, and so it was probably implied by what you shared, Seth, but just to make it explicit, knowing, like, let's say you get really pissed off at the counter, like, then you go to your hotel room or you go wherever you go, like, then you can take the time when you're on your own to, like, go through it more slowly and to kind of renegotiate the event that happened, so you can give yourself the chance to really feel what you were feeling and to, like, let it express without worrying about taking someone's head off. Yeah. Right. So that's the only thing I would add.
Right.
So I'm going to go to the next question.
Yeah.
And that is, hi, I'm coming out of freeze and old survival stress is now constantly present as anxiety, sometimes debilitating. I would like to release old stuff. I know this is a natural process, but I wonder if I'm facilitating it effectively. I'm in my head all the time due to intrusive thoughts, dysregulation. I often avoid the body sensations and instead resource externally. This helps me to function, but it doesn't seem to solve the anxiety at the root. How do I navigate this? What would you suggest? Okay. So first, I want to point out that there's a lot that's there's lots of clues that things are working here, right? Because remember, as we come out of freeze, we do feel that underlying activation, which this person is referring to as it's old, present as anxiety, sometimes debilitating. The intrusive thoughts are also a symptom of that underlying activation. And so if you listen to the question a few questions back about the person who had the thoughts and the fear, everything that we said there applies to this too. So you might go back and listen to that too. So the clues that things are going well is that you're coming out of freeze, right? So that tells us what you're doing is working. You're resourcing, you're avoiding sensations and resourcing externally. And for a while, when we're building capacity, that can actually be helpful, right? Because what we're feeling can be too much, as you're naming by saying it's debilitating. And then the other thing is that you're saying it helps you to function. Like, that matters, right? So we wanna notice that there are things that are working here, right? And to repeat what we said earlier is it can take some time. So part of what we need to do is keep growing access to safety, right? It's that safety, that capacity, that regulation that helps to make more space to hold that underlying what you're naming as anxiety. And within that anxiety, there may be many other things, right? There may be some grief, there may be some anger, there may be some shame, we don't know. But as you grow capacity and regulation and awareness, that will all become more apparent. So one of the things I want to say here is, like, keep doing what you're doing, because there are many clues that it's working, right? You didn't mention containment. That's another one that can often be helpful when we're feeling a lot and what we're feeling feels like too much. Just a very quick recap, going back to what we shared, is to keep offering yourself those physiologic cues of safety. And then when you have the intrusive thoughts, kind of coming back to, okay, I feel my arm, I feel my butt on the chair, I move my toes, and then checking in to see if you can name what's real in the moment to start to differentiate from those well-practiced thoughts and stories in the heads. And there may be images too, right? So just to know that it takes time, practice, and repetition, and that it does change and things will continue to evolve. So yeah, Seth, what would you add to that one? Anything?
The only thing I would say is that if you want to talk about the thing that you're looking at down the line from here, like, because you ask, you know, sort of how do, you're kind of asking, how do I solve this at the root? Well, eventually it will be about being with the sensations. and just allowing them to be present, the sensations of fear, you know, to be present without fearing them. That's what you're building the capacity for. Part of that may also involve mobilization, as we've talked about in the past. So what does that fear want to do? Doesn't want you to run, doesn't want you to fight. That's again, coming into the healthy aggression work, follow your impulse, what needs to happen that didn't get to happen. All that kind of stuff is kind of what you're pointing towards. And it sounds like you're doing a really good job of getting there. It's just like, keep doing what you're doing and start dropping in. Well, maybe I can feel the sensation of this for 5 seconds before I distract myself and resource externally, right? Like Jen said, what you're doing is working, and that's actually really important for building capacity. And just so you know, the next thing down the line does mean feeling the body. It's just, you don't have to do it all at once.
Yeah. And then the other thing to build on what you just said, Seth, is that sometimes using things like image, like putting the fear outside yourself, like mm-hmm. when there's so much going on, doing things like that can help to be a way to titrate it and to tone down the intensity and make it more workable. So just to sort of play an art, you mentioned art earlier. So things like that can be ways to titrate.
Yeah, my fear looks like this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can put it really far away, or you can mm-hmm. like, you know, tearing it up can be some agency mm-hmm. or burning it. Right? There's lots of options.
Yeah.
Okay. So next question. As long as I can remember, I have always, I'm going to turn my camera off. Sorry. Hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As long as I can remember, I have always felt cold, and I am finding myself craving heat, sauna, hot water bottles, standing beside radiators, especially when I get triggered. Is this external heat good for me? I put that in quotes, or helpful for my healing? Although the heat feels like a relief in the moment, sometimes I don't feel that good afterwards, and I'm wondering if it's just a band-aid or even preventing my body from doing the healing work it needs to do. Do you have any insights? So I just want to share personally, this was my experience too. Like, I was cold like a lot of my life. I didn't have great temperature regulation, and for that reason, I had a really hard time with winter, and that has completely changed. Like, I'm definitely by far not the coldest person in the room. I love winter. So just to kind of share that for the fun of it. But so just to know that, like, we're talking this call, the focus of this call is early developmental trauma. And as you may have heard us say in other calls, some of the things that help with that, like as humans, we need warmth, right? To help us to sort of feel safe and to feel held and cared for. We need softness and touch and presence, right? So to the degree that it feels at all supportive, right, warmth can be helpful. If you don't feel good afterwards, then that might be a clue to experiment a bit, right? Do you do it less? Is, for example, like maybe if you go into the sauna, instead of going for 10 minutes, you go for 3 minutes, right? Maybe you turn the thermostat down from 105 to 97, right? I'm just making things up. But the point there is, if the idea of warmth can actually be healing, but if it doesn't feel great, you want to listen to that and experiment to see what might feel better, right? I'm just looking here. I have some notes. Just to kind of draw some connections to what's going on, remember that freeze, it reduces circulation, kind of slows everything down. It sends the blood to the core and away from the extremities. So it makes a lot of sense that we're cold. I also want to name that sometimes some of us who have a lot of high sympathetic going on, and we have a lot of what we call hypertonicity, so lots of tension in the body, we might also be really cold. So it's not only freeze that would cause someone to be very like chronically cold, right? So that can be helpful to know. We also don't have as much flow in the system, right? So as we have more access, like all the things that help with capacity and regulation, right? Like everything that you're probably already doing, but things like the kidney adrenal practices, right? The diaphragms, anything that just kind of brings, helps the system find settling, increases our access to flow, increases circulation, all the things that support warmth, because often this does change over time. It does not at all sound like it's just a band-aid. I would, again, really trust your impulse there and your instincts and experiment a bit. And I'm just seeing if there's, oh, the other thing is sometimes play with this, but sometimes, like, you know, doing like the kidney adrenal practice in the bath or putting, doing the practices with warmth might also be something to experiment with as well. Seth, what would you add there?
Couple things. One thing to note, this caught my attention. If you're using heat and it's feeling good, but then afterwards you say, sometimes I don't feel that good afterwards. Well, it's also possible that that not feeling good is another part of the process, right? Like if say you have been in freeze your whole life, which is a probability, given what you're describing. If that's starting to thaw and the heat helps that and feels good, and then you feel like a little sick or a little like, afterwards, it's actually possible that that is actually part of what's needing to come out, right? Like it's not always a bad thing to feel bad. Essentially is what I'm saying as part of this work. Sometimes it's just part of it. I mean, there's a one time when I had this huge layer of freeze lift off of me, and it was like 2 or 3, I don't know, hours that I was just shivering and cold, and I couldn't get warm. And then like I had my feet in hot water. And as I was sitting with my feet in hot water and I had blankets all wrapped around me and a toque on, then I started to feel flu-like heat, body chills, achy, feverish. And that was all just part of this freeze lifting. So all that to say, everything Jen said is absolutely valid. And also it's not always a bad thing to feel bad in the context of this work. The only other thing I thought of was Ilya's movement lessons. They may be supportive as well as another way of getting flow moving through the system, because they are quite gentle and very supportive of flow and movement. So, all right. This question, how do you differentiate between what is early developmental trauma and what is generational trauma? My SE therapist thinks that my big emotions of feeling unseen and undervalued also stems from my lineage and culture. My mom and grandmother had intense life experiences that would explain the intensity of my emotions. The intensity in which I experience these emotions doesn't feel proportionate to my experience. How can I work this and process what's just mine? All right. So first part, how do you differentiate between what is EDT and what is generational trauma? I'm going to say actually they're both the same thing. And this may not be the answer that you're hoping for, but at this point, it's all yours, essentially. Because what happens is the intergenerational trauma is expressed through the genome. Right? We have genetic adaptations that are made, and we all have a variety of genetic potential. This is what epigenetics is showing us. And under certain circumstances, these genetic traits will express, and under certain circumstances, these genetic traits will express. And when we inherit genetic predisposition of expression, that's where that intergenerational trauma is. It's in the genome, in the ways that we're predisposed to express through our genetics. So it is itself probably the earliest form of early trauma, intergenerational trauma, because it's in the genome that informs our structure, right? So it's the same thing. And at this point, it's all yours. Like you are the one who has inherited it. So while there may be aspects of your mom's experience or your grandma's experience or your aunt's experience wrapped up in there, at this point, you're the one who gets to heal it. So, yay, sorry, but that's kind of the way it goes. It's also important to recognize that we inherit strengths as well as this genetic trauma. We also inherit all the strength of our ancestors because they survived long enough to make you, right? So you also inherit all of their positive adaptations. And I think there can be a great deal of importance in claiming what I would call pride of ownership. It's like, yeah, okay, it's all in my basket now. And guess what? I'm the one who gets to change it. I'm the one in my lineage who gets to stand up and say, you know what? I'm going to do something different. I'm not going to pass this on. I'm going to heal it and change it for my entire lineage. There's a great deal of power in that. And I think you can take a lot of pride in that and being the one who stands up and makes the change rather than just passing it on. Mm-hmm. Another thing to understand is that these genetic expressions are reinforced through behavioral expressions. So we come in with a certain genetic makeup, and then the way that our caregivers, family system, school system, whatever is around us impacts us is a big part of what determines how that genome expresses. Right? That's where we may get the more maladaptive expression or the more positive expression, depending on the circumstance. And the good news is that can change also at any time. So as you start to do this work and you start to look at your relationships and you put up boundaries as appropriate and you orient to the fact that you have a safe home environment, which hopefully you do. If not, that's a first step, right? We have to create safety in our lives, real safety, so that our internal danger cues, even though they are convinced they're real, like Jen said way back at the beginning of the call, we can start to say, look, no, I am actually literally safe. And I hear you that you feel that's not true, but yet here's this thing, right? As we create more safety in our lives, both externally and internally through doing this work, the genetic expression can change at any point. We can start to activate our more healing genetic DNA, our healing genetic expression. And that changes everything. That changes our health, right? It changes a lot of stuff. So that's the big picture answer there. And hopefully that is acceptable. But yeah, it's kind of like, yep, it's all in your basket now. So you get to be the one who changes it. All right, Jen, I think you have the last one.
I do. And I'm just realizing, so everyone, let's put our thinking caps on because this is a little bit of a headier one. So it might have been one for the beginning. So we'll see how we do. I'm going to state, can you hear me okay?
Right now I can.
Okay, look, give me a signal if you can't, because I want to demonstrate something. So I was going to stay on camera.
Okay.
The question is, hey, Jen and Seth, last time you mentioned the reciprocal relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. I read in Kathy Kane's book, and they're referring, I'm assuming, to the book Nurturing Resilience, that this relationship can be disturbed, and I felt like this applied to me. I have early developmental trauma, and in my healing journey, I have often noticed states of danger and safety in my body at the same time. I still experience this sometimes when I'm triggered and I bring in the ventral, that I can clearly feel I'm in ventral now, but the sympathetic charge is still stuck there. How can I work with this? So first, just a bit of education is that, like, if you imagine that your left hand is a sympathetic system, and your right hand is the parasympathetic system, reciprocal relationship looks like the sympathetic system starts to come up and reaches a point, and then the parasympathetic system comes in and brings it down, right? And then the sympathetic system goes up, and then the parasympathetic system comes in and brings it down. So they're working together, right? The sympathetic system gives us, like, I want to stand up and I want to go for a brisk walk. And then I want to, it's really more complicated than this. I'm oversimplifying, but then I want to go home and lay on the couch and veg out, right? So that would be the sympathetic system dominant and then the parasympathetic system dominant, right? What happens with trauma, not only early trauma, is that they get out of reciprocal relationship. And so you often hear Irene or others of us talk about gas on, brake on, right? That's not a reciprocal relationship because you have the sympathetic system on and the parasympathetic system on at the same time. And then we have freeze when we have the sympathetic system on, and then the parasympathetic system comes in on top of that sympathetic system that's on, but they're at the same time, right? So there's many different ways it can be out of the reciprocal relationship, but that's one of them, right? And just to know that that's common with trauma. So the other key element of what this person is sharing is that they experience both safety and danger in their body in the same time. And again, I want to say, like, there's some good stuff here because you have access to safety, right? You have access to ventral. Like, some of us, it takes an awfully long time to grow that. So that's something that's a strength that you can build on. So in terms of practices, the finding the painful and the pleasant practice could be a really helpful one, kind of reviewing pendulation. The other thing you say is that the sympathetic charge is still stuck, right? So I'd get it. That makes me a little curious, right? Because it sounds like you have access to ventral, but there's this underlying sympathetic charge. So how can you grow awareness of what's happening there, right? Can you tune in and feel it in more detail? Like, maybe start by noticing where you feel the sympathetic charge or how you feel the sympathetic charge. Sometimes it helps more to see, like, okay, I can't quite feel it, but I can see an image of it, right? Or I can see a color. So to work through imagery, if it feels hard to access, it's a really foundational one, but noticing if there's an impulse present, right? So maybe, like, I feel the sympathetic charge and I can't quite access it, but I know I just want to, like, I want to, like, wiggle or move, right? I always think of you, Seth, with this one, but sound. And there's that, it's almost like a hidden lesson. I think it's the extra resources in Lab 5. So it's working with the sound chambers of the body, but noticing, like, okay, again, maybe I can't quite feel this, but is there a sound that wants to come? Or can I imagine what this would sound like if it could come out, right? So there's different ways that we can tune in and access things that feel hard to access when we don't feel like they're easy to connect with. But again, like, it can be, sometimes what starts to happen for those of us who have a lot of threat, we start to feel scared and our belly gurgles at the same time, right? That's a good sign because we're growing access to sort of, like, okay, there's some safety here, even though we feel scared, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that you feel some ventral, even though there's some sympathetic there that feels like it's stuck, that's a good sign and something to build on. Over to you, Seth.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. The fact that you can feel more ventral and there's still, you still sense the sympathetic, that means that you've grown quite a bit of capacity, and it may be, yeah, time to start working with that sympathetic and all the ways Jen talked about, what's the sound it wants to make? How do I want to move? What's a little sympathetic-y kind of thing I can bring into this? Is there aggression? Do I need to work with the healthy aggression tools, et cetera? Maybe it's time to start bringing in that stuff. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And I just want to address one thing that I saw in the chat before we sign off, because it was in response to the last thing I was answering about generational trauma. What if you only start healing after your children are grown? Then you've already passed the intergenerational trauma onto your children. True, that can happen. And it's something that a lot of people come to realize as, you know, older people who get into this work who've already had kids. And it's important to acknowledge that. It can be important, depending on the nature of the relationship, to express that to your kids. And that can be part of the healing. Sometimes that's quite moving for children, for a parent to say, hey, I just realized, you know, I had a lot of trauma, and I'm realizing I've passed some of this on to you guys. And I see that in these ways. And I'm sorry, you know, and I just want you to know I'm working on it. Like having that expression can be quite powerful and healing in and of itself, but also know it actually is never too late to do this generational healing. And the way that it can ripple out is pretty amazing sometimes. It doesn't maybe always happen, but I've seen it and I've heard many cases where parents of adult children start doing this work. And even though the kids are grown in their 20s or 30s, they start to have an easier time of it. So that generational connection is quantum in nature as well as biological, I believe. And that quantum nature means that that healing can move through space and time in both directions. My dad got softer and more vulnerable after I did my work, trauma work, even though he did nothing. So the ways that this impacts our family system is kind of mysterious, and it can happen at any time, right? So communication, acknowledgement, and just trust that as you do your work, it will impact your whole family system in a positive way. Okay, thanks so much, everybody. Thank you, Jen, as always. Thank you, Mark, very much for being here. Thank you, Bonnie. And thank you all. Now, we've got a break week next week, so please take advantage of that and do your best to not work too hard. I know you all have lives, but yeah, find ways to do good things for yourself, pleasurable things for yourself as you can. Make a pleasurable activity a neurosensory exercise. What are the sensations of my body as I eat this hot fudge sundae? By God. Yeah. All right.
Great. Thanks, Seth. Thanks,
all right, everyone. Everybody. Thanks, Mark. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.